Okay,
and
fine.
I'm going to start with...
Just cutting right out of San Diego's big news story about Top Gun 2. No, that's fine.
I think...
That's fine. Google it.
I think everyone will be fine. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host from San Diego, Keith Foster.
And with me is the host of this show, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
You can just call me co-host. We're co-co-hosts. You're not the Ed McMahon to my Johnny Carson.
I am not taking anything that resembles ownership of this show.
Or responsibility. This is,
no, yeah, this is your show that I'm on.
Okay.
In my mind, I'm still replacing Richard.
Okay, if that's a dynamic you want, then it is, I will remind you that all the time.
I want zero responsibility.
Oh, boy. So we took a little bit of a summer vacation. You took a vacation. You visited home. And then later, I visited home.
Yeah. We shoved so much into one weekend. We visited basically everyone from our past in one weekend. We went home to Pocatello. I did a... reunion, a little mini reunion show with the Comedy Project. There were six people in the audience, so it felt normal. We went to Ashley's high school reunion. Then the next day, we drove to Portland. Or no. The next day, we drove to like the middle of nowhere, Oregon, for another one of our high school friends' wedding. And then the day after that, we drove to Portland, and we were in Portland for like a day and a half, basically. So we did all the stops. We basically saw everyone for like a couple hours.
Right.
4 days total, like including travel days.
How's the old co-host, Richard?
He's good. He's good. We finally met his baby in IRL, in real life. She's very sweet. I don't know. I love Richard. He's one of those people that, you know, it's like, no matter how much time passes in between times I see him, it's like we just pick up where we left off.
For sure. What would you have done if you had gone there and they showed you the new house, whatever, and, you know, then you're like, oh, where's the baby? And they, like, took you into, like, the baby's room, and it's, like, all done up and everything, and everything's on the walls, and, you know, the dressers and diapers everywhere. And then you look inside the bassinet or whatever, and there's just, like, a doll. And then they were, like, 100% serious of treating it as their daughter.
So this is funny. This reminds me of a... there was a point in time when I was, like, working on some sketches with my wife and a couple of friends that we do improv with. And we thought that would be, like, a really hilarious sketch. This, like, person who has a baby that they... Or a doll that they treat like a baby. And so they're, like, on the street and stuff. And, you know, they're like, oh, my baby! But then we found out that there's actually a super sad thing where, like, women who have miscarriages, sometimes, like, therapists and stuff will give them therapy dolls to treat like a real baby to help them, like, go through the grieving process. So it was, like, something that we were making fun of, like, oh, that'd be so crazy. And it's actually I've actually seen that. I've seen a woman with, like, she was pushing a stroller, and she had a doll in the stroller, and I knew the backstory, and I was just like, oh, Jesus Christ. and I felt super bad for making fun of him. So you should feel like a real asshole right now.
But that was just your way of getting out of my ridiculous hypothetical.
Well, I mean, no, I, so, okay, if we're, going to go, if we're going to go down this route, if we're going to go down the fucking hypothetical route, because of this backstory, I would feel so bad and weird, and I would try to help. I'd probably play along with it, honestly, because I know that, there's got to be some, like, deep psychological issues for them to have pretended like they have a fucking 2-year-old. So I'm not going to be the one who bursts that bubble.
Okay, fair enough. Today we're going to be talking about the Ant-Man and Wasp.
You don't want to talk about your trip at all?
I will here in a second. Ant-Man and Wasp, and I'm also going to review Sicario, the sequel, Day of the Soldado. And at the end of the program, for the Netflix homework, we're going to review 54, the Studio 54 biopic. Yeah, I did the vacation thing too. I went back to Pocatello. And I, you know, it's fairly uneventful. My brother lives at home now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's working out of Pocatello now, and he's staying with my folks until he can find a place or whatever. So, I got to see him, like, actually probably more than anybody, and that's pretty cool, because I haven't seen, I think it's been, like, a good, like, 4 to 5 years since I've seen him. Because he was a trucker for a long time, and he was all over the place, and, you know, it was hard to kind of, like, plan his job around my vacations and whatever. He was living in Chicago for a really long time, so... So that's who I saw them for the most part. Everybody else is gone, and you know that.
Yeah.
Like, as far as friends go, it is a ghost town. So it's kind of a weird, like, you can't go home again sort of thing. It's like, oh, this is home, but it's not. Oh,
for sure. For sure. It's like, it feels like, it feels like you're going into, like, a Tracy Letts novel or something. Like, Tracy Letts play, where it's just, like, super depressing, and I don't like it at all.
Yeah, you know, I mean, my plan was really just to relax, so I tried to do as little as possible, because this is, I've spent all my vacation time for, you know, the next however long. So I did a lot of that. I did get to see our old roommate Adam, we spent a couple days together, so that was cool. But yeah, other than that, I didn't really do anything. There's not much to talk about there. I did the 4th of July thing, the day I arrived was my dad's birthday. So, but even then, you know, I think we went to a Texas Roadhouse. That was his birthday present.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. That's okay. Like,
yeah,
you came home. You know what I mean? Like, that's not nothing.
No, yeah, I mean, like I said, the goal was to relax. That's why I didn't plan a show. I've done shows on vacation before, dragged them. Well, I don't have a laptop anymore, so that had a lot of reason why I didn't even bother. But yeah, you know, I just kind of didn't want to have to deal with anything, so I didn't.
No, that's good. That's good. I've noticed more and more, like, I don't know, just more and more people I know sort of, like, unplugging. Like, any more, a vacation almost just means, like, I'm not going to be checking my fucking phone that I'm a slave to.
Oh, I was on my phone the whole time.
All right. Okay.
I mean,
like... I mean, yeah, but you also picked Pocatello to vacation and not, right, like,
anywhere
Rio
else.
De Janeiro.
Yeah. Well, maybe next year. Let's go ahead and get into the movie news. We have a little bit here that we found during our summer vacation.
Movie news. Talk about that movie news.
I want you to start with this one, because I don't really understand it. A viral ghost story, Dear David, to become film?
Yeah, okay. So there is this, a Twitter user, Adam Ellis. He's like a cartoonist. He used to work for BuzzFeed. So he like did cartoons and fun little articles for BuzzFeed. So he's kind of, you know, has kind of a well-known social profile. Mm-hmm. And he started doing this ghost story. He started tweeting how he was like being haunted by this, like he was having dreams about this weird little dead boy. And then he like kept tweeting about like supernatural occurrences that were having. He was having his apartment, and he was treating him as if they were real. I figured out pretty quickly that it was like 100% bullshit.
Right.
And there's some people on social media who like took it as fucking truth. It's sort of like a and it went like super viral. So it's sort of like a weird, it's like the Twitter version of War of the Worlds almost.
Right. This happens every once in a while. Like there was that, like Lonely Girl, whatever, YouTube account, like the early days of YouTube, like 2006 or and seven or something, where she was supposed, you started the channel just thinking she was just this teenage girl doing a video blog. And then as the show progressed, she was like, oh, I just found out all this weird stuff about my dad. And then, like, all of a sudden, the CIA is after her, and it just gets crazier and crazier. And then you realize it was all scripted from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what this is like. But I don't know. I think it's kind of a cool, like, sort of Twitter experiment.
Type of storytelling.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I got super annoyed with all the people who thought it was real. And I'm just like, no, this is clearly fake. Like, come on. Mm-hmm. But I also, like, followed the thread because it was very entertaining and pretty spooky. Like, even knowing it's totally fake, and I don't think he ever came out and said it was fake, but, like, I think it ended with David possessing him.
That's fun.
But what I think is interesting is that they're, like, so they're taking that. They're taking a Twitter thread and they're developing it into a movie? I mean, here's the thing. The ghost story itself, I don't think was like that spectacular of a ghost story. What made it stand out was the fact that he was tweeting it. That it was
the format.
It was a long form fiction experiment. Right. It, you know, it was someone. It was someone trying to create art in a new medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so my opinion is, like, just let that be that. And, like, do we really need a movie of it? I just don't know.
I don't know how you do this without it just being a generic ghost story. Like, I suppose you could incorporate an internet element into it, like maybe like the Unfriended series.
Sure. And, you know, it might be fine. I think, you know, a decent director could probably do all right with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't really need it. Good for fucking him. You know, he's a freelance artist. He was, an online writer at BuzzFeed.
Uh-huh.
He quit his job to like be full-time freelancer. So good for fucking him for selling it and
respect making, for the hustle.
Yeah. I don't know. And maybe a millennial. Oh, God. I am a millennial. Millennials are in their 30s and reaching 40s. Right. Fuck that. Maybe a younger audience will really find something to connect with. And you know, maybe a young, cool director could do something cool with it. I don't really need it as a movie, is my point.
Yeah, I don't see how you do it without it being fairly generic, because I think the whole point of it was the way the story was being told, but, you know, I'm sure the account had hundreds of thousands of followers, so they think that's a built-in audience.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, this next story I'm sure is going to excite you. Jared Leto is set to star in Sony's Morbius the Living Vampire movie. So Morbius the Living Vampire was a character, kind of D-villain in the Marvel Universe. Showed up in Spider-Man a lot. Kind of a hokey dude. I think he runs across the Blade universe a little bit too, here or there.
Yeah, he was like a super vampire, basically.
Yeah, and he was kind of like a tragic vampire. Like, he was kind of, you know, didn't want to be and blah, blah, blah. There's a movie to be made in that, even though we kind of went through a vampire saturation point already. I think doing a vampire story within sort of a superhero context or within a superhero universe, you could do something cool with that. I always actually wanted, back when they were still making Blade movies, I thought Morbius would be a cool villain.
Sure. Yeah.
But instead, well, we're getting
I mean, I think Morbius could be a cool villain, like, even if you just threw him as, like, a Spider-Man villain, you know, and give, give like, a Spider-Man movie more of a horror bent, I think could be interesting. Like, there's stuff to mine from that character, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even though all the ways I've ever seen him portrayed in the comics and in the cartoon was always kind of silly, it doesn't have to be that way.
No, I mean, in the fucking cartoon, he couldn't drink blood, so he, like, absorbed people's plasma through these weird, like, squid suctions on his hand.
Right, and I think because it was a kid's cartoon, he couldn't actually say blood, so he always said plasma.
Yeah, I must have the plasma! yeah, he was super cheesy in the cartoon, but I don't think he has to be.
No. But, you know, obviously I know what you're going to say about this. There's two things that are problematic about this. First of all, is this a continuation of Sony trying to maintain...
No one knows!
Trying to maintain the, whatever vestige of the Spider-Man universe they want to do, because they're still they're making that Venom movie, or the Venom movie's coming out this year, and then they
Damn. Have you seen the trailer for that? That looks like hot trash.
Yeah, it looks like the Spawn movie.
Sony needs to just, like, they need to shit or get off the pot with the Spider-Man thing. Like, they you know, they gave Spider-Man back to Marvel. Just, like, just get over it. Just stop. No one wants your vision of the... Like, anytime you see, you know, information about these movies, what is the first thing people say? Like, so-and-so to finally join the MCU? Like, they don't want you to have it, Sony.
Yeah.
Just stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the second thing is Jared Leto, who might be the worst actor of our generation.
I don't think so. But, and I don't even think necessarily he's a bad casting choice, but I think that everything around the making of this movie and the reason it's being made is not going to play to his strengths.
Yeah, it's going to play to him being a self-indulgent weirdo.
Yeah, this is basically going to be a 2-hour-long 30 Seconds to Mars video.
Yeah, zero interest. I would be a lot more interested if this character was to, like, sort of challenge an already established character. And, like, I don't know, I think it'd be cooler to sort of throw a character against genre than just do a fucking vampire piece.
Yeah, it's going to fail miserably, too, because nobody gives a fuck about Morbius.
No, I mean, I think the Venom movie is going to struggle, and Venom actually has, like, a huge cult fan base, so if that can't get off the ground, I think good luck, Morbius.
Yeah, I doubt Morbius will happen if that's the case. Jim Carrey is to play Dr. Robotnik, the villain from Sonic the Hedgehog video games, in the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. And I saw this story online and thought, okay, whatever. I doubt we'll even talk about this. This is, you know, I'm sure he's just doing a voice or something. But the internet kind of exploded about this news. Like, maybe it was just a slow week for internet news, so they were really trying to milk it. But I kept seeing the story over and over and over again. And yeah, you know, as a joke, I put here the role he was born to play, finally. Do you care? Do you want a Sonic the Hedgehog movie, first of all? And does it matter who does the voice of Dr. Robotnik?
Okay, a couple things here. First of all, I have a feeling, like, a Sonic the Hedgehog movie is going to be, you know, probably catered pretty much just towards kids. So yeah,
I imagine it's going to be pretty pedestrian, like the Ratchet and Clank movie.
Yeah. Wait, what?
You didn't know about the Ratchet and Clank movie that came out last year?
No. Are you joking?
It came and went. It was really not good. Even people I know who are, like, diehard Ratchet and Clank video game fans were not happy with it.
Hmm.
But
I think Sonic the Hedgehog, like, I don't know, of all the sort of video game properties, I feel like that one could lend itself pretty well to like a kids movie, you know.
Sure. It had a cartoon for a long time.
Yeah, and they had a comic book. Like, there is a story behind Sonic that I think you could have some fun with. I think it's all going to kind of come down to who's writing it and producing it. Mm-hmm. As for Jim Carrey, yeah, I mean, I think he'll be fine, but so when I heard this news, I heard it because it was tweeted out by Henry Zebrowski from the last podcast on the left. Okay. And he has a decent career as a character actor. He's been in, you know, a lot of like canceled TV shows and stuff.
Okay.
He had like a character, one of the character specials on the Netflix characters series. His was definitely the worst one. His was pretty bad. But in general, I'm a fan of Henry Zebrowski. And after listening to hours and hours and hours of last podcast on the left, he tweeted out something about how, like, how pissed he was that Jim Carrey got this part because he, you know, it was like the role he was born to play. And if you, I totally agree with him. Like, I could hear him playing this part so hard. I can't really hear Jim Carrey doing it.
Oh, he's going to do a funny voice. I love Jim Carrey. You know.
Sure. It frustrates me because I know there's a better casting out there.
Right. But Jim Carrey, putting him on the poster, his name, is going to do a lot more for Sonic the Hedgehog than this other guy. But
I know.
Yeah. You know, I mean, not that it really matters. Kids don't care at all.
No,
especially with an animated film. I thought in my head that what would make this casting rumor a lot more interesting and me a lot more interested in a Sonic movie is if they went the old video game to feature adaptation route of the early 1990s, where they tried to do it in live action and everyone's in really awkward makeup and prosthetics.
Oh my God, yes.
In a giant soundstage that's obviously a soundstage the whole time.
But even then, Henry Zebrowski is so much better for the part. It's frustrating to me. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, good for them. They landed a star, now people kind of care.
Well, they did that week anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's call this our last story. Greta Gerwig to helm Little Women at Sony, starring Meryl Streep, Emma Stone, Timothy Chalamet, Saoirse Ronan, a lot of people who's won Oscars or been nominated for Oscars recently. Greta Gerwig wants an Oscar, is what it seems like to me. Little Women, you know, I never read the book or seen the movie. I know very little about it. It's supposed to be a sad book or something like that. It's a you know, popular coming of age novel that a lot of girls read growing up, kind of around the same time that guys are reading Catcher in the Rye.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, as far as like Greta Gerwig and her thing and like, you know, sort of her literary past and whatever, I think that'll fit into her brand as a director. And I'm just excited to see whatever she does next. And this is a good cast. It does seem a little Oscar baity, but you know, from her, I don't care.
Yeah. I don't know that I've seen enough of her stuff. Like I saw Lady Bird. What else has she done?
Well, I mean, that was her directorial debut as a, you know, feature film director, but she co-wrote Frances Ha and Mistress America with Noah Baumbach, and she's been actress in a ton of movies before that.
Yeah. I think I would have liked to see something more along the lines of Lady Bird as a follow-up. I mean,
something original.
Yeah, just sort of, I don't know. I mean, it seems like this is probably in her wheelhouse, but mm-hmm. I don't know. Hasn't this story been adapted a lot? And
yeah, I mean, you know,
not that that's a deal breaker. Like, you know,
there was a pretty popular version in the 90s with Winona Ryder and Christian Bale. And
yeah. And I guess that's a while ago. I just, I don't know, and I don't think I'm the target audience for this, really. But I mean, it doesn't really do anything for me.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm just hearing Little Women movie being remade, I have zero interest, really. Not enough to not a negative interest. I'm not like actively against the idea, but I'm also not excited by it either. But it's really the cast and the fact that Greta Gerwig's working again, and I think from the strength of Lady Bird, I want to see how she approaches this, especially something that's not original. And you know, I think this is her kind of sort of trying to prove herself as like, I'm not just an indie darling. I can, you know, play with the work that everyone's really familiar with.
I guess. I mean, I get that. I don't know. I just don't. I personally don't really care. I think I would have preferred to see her another one of her own things first.
I'm sure she will at some point. I don't think, you know, she's going to go from this to doing like, you know, another superhero movie or something. But you never know.
It's just not for me.
All right.
Maybe it's misogynistic or whatever, but I just hear the name Little Women and I'm like, that's not for me. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's okay that I'm just like, I think that's great for people who, you know, like, I'm sure Ashley will be into that and I'll probably see it with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but this isn't something that I would seek out on my own.
Right, right.
But I mean, it does have a great cast, and you know, Lady Bird was great. Like how Alex Garland followed up Ex Machina with Annihilation.
Right.
I would like to see Greta Gerwig's Annihilation.
No, I know what you mean, and I think to some extent this is what that is.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think slightly more ambitious project. It's a little further away from her. She's creating some amount of creative separation. So it's not just her making her own little movies, like, you know, she's playing dolls with these actors. And not that I think that that's a problem, but I think that is a perception she's worried about. And so
I guess Annihilation was a
an adaptation novel. Yeah. So I
guess it's just like maybe it would excite me more if it was something that was I guess just existed less.
Let's go ahead and get into the movie reviews then.
Okay,
and fine. I'm going to start with
cutting right out of San Diego's big news story about Top Gun 2. No, that's fine. That's fine. Google it.
I think everyone will be fine. I'm going to start here with Sicario, Day of the Soldado, which is the sequel to the Denis Villeneuve film from 2015. This does bring back the writer Taylor Sheridan, who also wrote Hell and High Water and Wind River, which we liked. But it's now directed by Stefano Salima instead of Denis Villeneuve. It's also not shot by Roger Deakins, which I think had a lot to do with the cinematic nature of the first Sicario. But this time around, we do not have Emily Blunt as our cipher into this story. Instead, we have now shifted the center of consciousness to Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin's character. Benicio del Toro playing sort of a mysterious hitman named Alejandro, and Josh Brolin, who works for a government agency, kind of a shady organization, drug administration kind of thing, Matt Graver. And this takes place on the border again. In fact, there's a lot of stuff in this movie where I was talking to a friend about it today. He went and saw it around the same time I did when here in California. And he said the first half of it was making him really nervous because there's a lot of stuff that's being talked about in this movie. And you sort of as genre fodder, really. They're not trying to have very like real or deep discussions about the, you know, in the international politics or anything like that. But because it takes place on the border, because it has to do with immigration, because it has to do with drug enforcement across the border, and sort of the thuggish behavior of certain government facilities and whatever to be able to overextend their power. Anyway, so a lot of this does kind of end up resonating, maybe more than it would have otherwise. I'm not 100% sure how intentional some of this stuff is.
Some stuff might resonate more than it would have due to sort of the political climate. And my question is, does Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin lock a bunch of those immigrant kids up in cages where they can't hurt us?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Let me go further into some of the plot stuff.
Oh, good. They really get those harmful babies.
The premise basically is that the deep state has hired Josh Brolin and his shady government agency, some drug enforcement agency, to start a fake war with a well-known drug dealer in Mexico by kidnapping their daughter and then pretending like the Americans have saved her to bring her back. That way they're hoping to pressure the president into extending the war on terror into the war on drugs over the border so that they can hyper-militarize the war on drugs.
Gotcha. Oh, Jesus. Yeah. I don't know if I want to watch this.
Exactly. The first half hour of the movie, you're kind of like, do we need this movie right now? I mean, they literally, and what causes them to want to do this is because they talk about how, they're worried, this government agency is worried that terrorists are being snuck across the border. Islamic
Jesus
terrorists.
Jesus Christ. I know. Is this a fucking, like, full-on propaganda film?
That's what I'm saying. For a little while, it starts to play into that narrative. It's almost sort of built on sort of the right-wing paranoia. I think the movie's aware of that. And I think that the movie does contradict that enough or argue against it enough or show that what it ends up becoming. It starts out as sort of this, this sort of taking right-wing propaganda about immigration and paranoia about immigration and sort of playing that out. And then it sort of transforms about midway through the movie as more of a critique about the military industrial complex and sort of America's role in that. And I think that turnaround is crucial for enjoying this movie at all.
Yeah. Sounds like rough.
And ultimately, I think Taylor Sheridan, he's a genre guy. You know, he is talking about this stuff and it is a part of the story, but I think ultimately he's seen a lot of Westerns. He's seen a lot of noirs. He's seen a lot of thrillers. This is his bread and butter. All of this stuff is window dressing and it happens to be super relevant window dressing, but it's window dressing so that he can do shootouts and revenge plots and that kind of stuff. So that's ultimately what the movie ends up sort of resonating as like, oh, okay, so you just wanted to have some really tense sequences. And I think that he achieves the new director, Stefano Salamo, he achieves that. Now, is it as good as the last Sicario? No, I don't think it is. I think this is a lot more of sort of a Taylor Sheridan genre piece and kind of a pulp movie. As opposed to the last one, which had pulp elements for sure, but I think because it came from a more sort of artistic sensibility, and then you have Roger Deakins shooting it in the way he did, that movie, I think, elevates that stuff a little bit more.
So here's my question. Here's me as the skeptical viewer of this movie, because I actually didn't care to see this. I was like, I really loved the first one.
Yeah.
None of the marketing worked for me on this one. To me, it looked like Boondock Saints 2.
It's not. It's not that.
Okay.
It's not.
So it's a decent sequel.
Yes. It's more like, and I don't know how this plays for everybody, but it's more like RoboCop 2. Or you know what? Or maybe even more so. It's kind of more like Aliens to Alien. It's like definitely in the same world, but the sensibility is fairly different, and it's more interested in being a genre piece than you know, building atmosphere and being a mood piece, which I would say what the first one was.
Okay. All right.
It's a type of movie you could see on Spike TV and totally be satisfied with.
Okay. So it's worth adding to my Netflix queue.
Yeah. And I would say it is a satisfying Redbox rental.
Cool. All right. That works for me.
I think that people who are not...
Yeah, I might wait for like an administration change or right. two.
People who want to be mad at this movie on either side of the aisle. People who want to be mad at this movie will find reasons to be mad at it. But ultimately, I don't think that the movie is even trying to trigger those sort of responses, but it's going to anyway.
Gotcha. Letter grade for
you? B minus.
Okay. All right.
All right. Let's go ahead and talk about Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I'll let you set that up.
Okay. So Ant-Man and the Wasp takes place... so we're starting to get into some fun Marvel timeline continuity things here. I mean, they kind of shoot these movies out of order, which I think is interesting anyway. But this one is like definitely out of order. So this, just assume it takes place before Infinity War, takes place a couple of years after the events of Captain America: Civil War. We find Scott Lang is on the last couple days of his house arrest for illegally suiting up as Ant-Man and helping the then fugitive Captain America. He's devoted to his daughter. He's trying to live his normal life.
Mm-hmm.
But he is somehow contacted by I can't think of his fucking name. Hank Pym, Michael Douglas's lost wife, the original Wasp, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, who they thought was lost to the quantum realm. But in the events of the first movie, when Ant-Man went down to the quantum realm to save everybody from whoever, if you're getting lost by all the pseudoscience, that's fine.
pay no attention.
Essentially, he is led back into the life of being Ant-Man, by Evangeline Lilly and Michael Douglas's characters. Along the way, they find some bad guys, and they're all trying to sort of get access to this quantum realm, for various reasons. Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's sort of the easiest way to set it up, because I think there is a lot sort of going on here. Yeah. I don't know. Do you want me to just sort of get into my thoughts on this?
Yeah,
Are we prepped enough?
I might talk about this. This is directed by Peyton Reed, who I believe did the first one as well.
Yeah.
He comes from a background of comedy. He did like movies like Yes Man. He was sort of the consolary director that we got after
Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright, who was originally supposed to do the first one, and then Peyton Reed stepped in. And I think there's an element of the first movie that had a kind of a lighter tone, a lighter touch. It was certainly sort of more decidedly comedic, but not necessarily in like a Guardians of the Galaxy or Thor Ragnarok way, where there's a lot of kind of setups and that kind of stuff, but just more like something, you know, it's a heist film, but it's like a character driven heist film with, you know, maybe something sort of along like the Oceans movies or something like that. But there's some comedic set pieces, but for the most part, it's still taking the genre stuff fairly seriously. and you tell me if you agree with it or disagree with this, but I think this movie is leaning into the comedy more as in a way that it's like, oh, okay, so this is what we're doing now. It's like, this is, we're a comedy. This is decidedly a comedic thing, and we're going to put that foot forward.
I don't necessarily think it was... I guess they yeah, I okay. let me just... Yeah, I mean, they were definitely like, we are treating this with a much lighter touch. It's easy, breezy, beautiful cover girl.
For sure.
And I think there's some pluses to that and some cons to that.
Agreed.
I think, so in general, my overall view of this movie, without getting into like the whole minutia of the MCU again and again and again.
Right, right.
To me, this definitely feels like lesser MCU.
Yeah.
And I think it achieved its purpose of being a palate cleanser from Infinity War, which is like all the things. And then this is like, okay, well, we're just going to just sort of bring it back down to one sort of silly hero who's also a dad, you know? So I think in that sense, it's successful. But I think this is one of Marvel's muddiest movies since Iron Man 2. And maybe it is because they're playing into the comedy so much that it feels like a lot of the story sort of gets shirked around and sort of exposition dumped and just sort of thrown out there, which I don't necessarily have a problem with.
I never felt the movie ever bloats. I never felt that there was like moments where I was lost at any point. I actually felt that the movie was almost streamlined to a fault. Like it's so unambitious and it's so small, itty bitty movie. As far as the scale of like what this, how many people this plot affects.
Yeah.
And then maybe it just seems that way coming on. No, not necessarily. And that's usually something I always ask for. I don't want to save the world every movie. I don't want to save the city every movie. And that's fine. But I think that ultimately it is Ant-Man and Wasp just trying to help Michael Douglas save his wife. That's the movie. That's the goal. And I think as a superhero movie that kind of becomes a little bit of a problem because there's nothing altruistic about that other than helping Michael Douglas, which is almost more of a family-oriented thing. They don't actually get to be superheroes. Like, when I saw Ant-Man and Wasp as the next title of the movie, I was like, okay, cool. Yeah. So they're going to be together. They're going to be doing stuff. And in this, it's like another movie where Scott Lang is sort of incidentally pulled into this other dynamic. And he kind of feels like a third wheel in his own movie.
Yeah, no, that I agree totally. When I saw Ant-Man and the Wasp, I thought the same thing as you, like Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly. But really, it's Ant-Man, Hank Pym, and the Wasp.
Yeah,
like it's way more about Michael Douglas, and even that I don't think is necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's the movie. It is. It's my problem. Curious that that's the dynamic that they've settled on. Like, oh, that's what this series is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of cool because it's like, I don't know, Scott Lang was never a huge... No, great. Now you got me going. Now I'm talking about Marvel comics. I mean, he was never a huge character in the comics. So I think I always thought it was cool how they tied Hank Pym in because he is a huge character in the comics. So
he's
the
more well-known Ant-Man, for sure.
Yeah, so I liked that dynamic. I think there was to me, the problem with this movie was there was a little bit too much trying to introduce new things and replay themes from the previous movie. I feel like this movie had a tough time being a sequel. And that's what I mean when I think it feels a little bloated, because like they're trying to do all this stuff. Like they're trying to, you know, introduce this character Ghost, who I thought was pretty cool. Like I liked all the individual elements of this movie. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that they totally coalesced. And, well, and maybe the comedic aspects kind of prevented that. I don't know. But like,
I think it does. I think that there's the touch is so light on this movie mm-hmm. that it almost undermines any kind of stakes or severity in these in the plot. Like, you never feel like anything is ever really a problem because the movie doesn't take itself seriously at all.
There's a specific scene I can think of with where Walton Goggins is, like, confronting Louise. And it's, like, instead of it being a tension-raising moment, it's a moment to call back Louise's, you know, like, fun, idiosyncratic quirks from the first movie, which I liked. Because I liked him in the first movie, I liked it. But he felt like you know, if Scott Lang feels like a third wheel, he feels like a sixth wheel. I'm like,
well, that's what I agree with you that they're kind of this feels a little built by committee in the sense that like somebody looked at like what pulls well in the first one. They're like people exactly. like Michael Pena, people like Hank Pym. Cracking wine.
And I did. I liked all those things. That's what's to me. It was just like it was trying to be a new thing. You know, like exploring mm-hmm. some new powers and stuff, and explore this idea of the quantum realm and all this stuff that wasn't really able to explore in the first movie. But they were also trying to be too beholden to the first one. I think it kind of has some sequelitis there. And that's what I mean when I compare it to Iron Man 2.
For it's sure. To
me, it felt like there was just sort of too much in the broth. And I also want to be like, I didn't dislike this movie. I wasn't like miserable watching it. It was what I expected and kind of needed. It was just sort of a light, fluffy. I mean, are there things I kind of wish they'd done differently? Sure. But I don't know. It was pretty much what I was expecting.
It's an unoffensive movie. But unfortunately, I think that's probably the best thing you can say about it is that it is digestible. But it does. I mean, I understand that they wanted to do something small and they wanted to do something kind of light and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a way you can do that and also tell a compelling story. I don't think this does that. I think it is light and it is mildly entertaining. I don't think it's nearly as funny as it thinks it is. I think that a lot of the jokes actually fall pretty flat. And I think that there's a lot of scenes that were kind of Frankenstein together in editing because some of the comedic beats or the comedic timing feels a lot like they had a bunch of actors who are well-versed in comedy, and they said, okay, just riff a little bit here with the scenes kind of come to an end, but just let's try some stuff. And then they kind of pieced together some punchlines and editing.
I will say there were a couple bits in this movie that did really tickle me.
I actually, the one you mentioned with Luis, I think is one of the better ones.
Mostly because it's
written and it's tight.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I agree on all those points. And like, again, there were some moments that I was like the only one laughing in the theater. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is as funny as the first one. I don't think that's even necessarily a problem, but I do if it's going to be a comedy.
Exactly.
I would have liked to see a little bit just more Ant-Man and the Wasp, like,
agreed.
Sort of kicking ass together.
Agreed. They never, it always kind of feels like it's Hank Pym and the Wasp and then this guy they have to get to help them.
Yeah. One other thing I want to point out is I feel like this movie was so obsessed with sort of new powers mm-hmm. that one of the things that I thought was really fun about the first one was sort of the unconventional aspect of the hero. Like, you know, he turns tiny. What? Yeah. But they still made it really cool, like exploring this this miniature world, mm-hmm. and you barely even got to see any of them being shrunk because the way the action scenes were directed, it all focused on the full size characters sort of, you know, pantomiming getting hit by a little character. And then they turn big and then they turn small, but you can't see them. And so you don't really get to explore that world of like, oh, this is what it's like to be, you know, like one of the things I thought that was cool about the first one is, it's a superhero movie meets Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Right.
So you get to like explore this cool alien landscape of your backyard and stuff like that. And it bummed me out that this movie didn't, like, it almost was ashamed of it. Like, it focused so much on them getting bigger or whatever. And, like, I thought, you know, they did that with the car and the lab and stuff. And,
yeah, there's and a little bit cool. of that. And I think when this movie does work, especially comedically, it's the sight gags.
Yes.
I think that is sort of the
scene at the school cracked me up. It was really funny.
There's a lot of stuff like that. And I think Paul Rudd is very naturally funny. He doesn't, you know, he knows how to use the camera to his advantage. He's the only person I think that can kind of just riff and be funny without having a punchline there. A lot of the other people, like Evangeline Lilly, not as good at that.
Yeah. No, I agree. Same with Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
I think he needs some written jokes.
Or Lawrence Fishburne.
I thought he was inoffensive, and I don't know. I liked the character. Like,
yeah,
that was me. I got some nerd moments when they brought him in. I was like, "Oh, that's really fun." I like that they went there, and I like that interpretation of the character. So I
agreed. But even that character, which is kind of heavy in the story, is treated so light that I never got any vibe off of it that this is a character I should be thinking about really at all.
Well, and his arc, I think his arc was one of the more disappointing ones because he just sort of changes his mind.
Right.
And there's not really any inciting action for that. But Peyton Reed has never been a particularly exciting director.
No.
I don't know. I wasn't super hyped about this movie. And like I said, I think the way Marvel, I've said this over and over and over again, I think the way Marvel sort of is serializing their films, this movie makes sense in the larger context of like the story they're trying to tell. Like,
right. You know, but in that sense, both this one and the first one, I think unfortunately they serve as sort of the mortar between the bigger bricks of the universe.
I agree. And I think the first one was more effective at being its own movie than this one is. Again, I think the easiest comparison is Iron Man 2. And a lot of people didn't like Iron Man 2. And you know what? It was I have a weird soft spot in my heart for it. And I think I have a weird soft spot for this, too. But I recognize that it's, you know, it's not Marvel's A game.
Right. So if it's not its A game, what is it?
I give it a B minus.
Okay, I'm going to give it a C plus. I think that there's a, it's just too disappointing in a lot of levels to really give it a full pass. But I do think it's inoffensive. Again, if you end up renting this later, you're going to, you know, or watching it on Netflix or something like that, you'll probably think it's fine. It's just, it just advances and forwards pretty much nothing, either in this universe or in the greater universe.
I think the biggest crime of this movie is the waste of Walton Goggins as an actor.
Yeah.
He's such a good character actor and such a good character villain if they had the rights to all of the Spider-Man universe, he would be a perfect Carnage. Like, pitch perfect.
Totes.
And also his character in the movie was completely unnecessary. Only muddied the actual story.
Uh-huh.
I love Walton Goggins, but I think if there was a Gogginsless cut of this movie, it would be better.
Yeah, kind of like the Sam Rockwell character in Iron Man 2. It was like
he's a
great actor, really fun role, but doing nothing for the story.
And a waste of talent, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Telling you, this is the next Iron Man 2. That's what it is.
I'd probably say Iron Man 2 is even a little better, to be honest. Okay, let's go ahead.
All right, well, I guess we're just going to agree to disagree.
Let's go ahead and talk about 54. 54, this is our Netflix homework, which I assigned to you last week. And I just realized that I never asked you what you were going to assign me. We'll talk
about that. Yeah, that's all right. I have something. Oh, okay. I have something, and you haven't seen it, so.
All right. So this was written and directed by Mark Christopher. It came out in 1998. We saw the 93-minute cut, but I know that just recently the director got a hold of his original cut and was able to re-release it. Director's cut is available on Amazon Prime, and I think you can buy it on Blu-ray as well. We saw the theatrical cut, which I know that the director was not as happy with, but it is what it is. This is a biopic about the famous disco, the New York Disco, Studio 54, stars Ryan Phillippe and Selma Hayek, Nev Campbell, and Mike Myers as the famous Steve Rubell, who started Studio 54 and infamously stood outside the line and told the people who was cool enough or interesting enough to enter his club. This club also housed a lot of celebrities at the time, and it was supposed to be sort of this debaucherous, crazy, drug-fueled, sex-capade 24-hour thing until Steve Rubell got caught by the IRS skimming money for himself and not claiming it on his taxes. And by the time he was out of jail, disco was dead, and that was kind of the end of that era. We enter the story through Ryan Phillippe's character, Shane O'Shea, a Jersey kid who wants to see what the New York nightlife is all about and ends up becoming sort of a waiter and a go-go boy at Studio 54. And he has dreams and aspirations, and everybody there, his sort of adopted family that he meets, all have dreams and aspirations of their own. And it's sort of a rise and fall story about that era and kind of about these characters, but more about the era. What did you think of 54?
Okay. A few things. The fact that you mentioned there's a director's cut, I think makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. It kind of felt like this movie felt sort of short and anticlimactic to me. Like, I all the performances I think were really good, especially Mike fucking Myers. Holy shit. He's great as Steve Rubell. And I think a lot of this movie at the time was sort of selling itself on his performance.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just felt like nothing really happened. Like I was enjoying what I was seeing, but it sort of felt like Goodfellas without any of the stakes.
Yeah, like
instead of like joining the mafia, he just like gets super into cocaine and disco, and it's like lots of people did. It was the 70s. I don't know. I felt like the movie was sort of it was sort of failing to take a real point of view on it. Like it wasn't saying this stuff happened. It wasn't which I think is fine that it wasn't indicting of it. Like, but it was also it was like near the end of it, it decides it sort of wants to like dip its toes into the idea of being a morality tale. But I don't know. It just felt sort of like weak.
No,
if you're going to be a morality tale, which I don't necessarily agree with, and I don't think that that's necessarily the right choice, but like you can't decide that all of a sudden in the third act.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. Like Ryan Phillippe's character arc, especially the stuff with Neve Campbell, I thought was really dumb. When she shows up, you know, at the club, I don't know. I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but I just feel like his character arc was real weak. And there, I don't know. There just was no consequences of anything in this movie. Like, to pick a point of view, like, does it enjoy the party? Is it sad, you know, when the eventual disco dies? Or, you know, is it like, well, this is what you had coming? I don't know. It just, It felt like it was trying to be too diplomatic about it all.
I agree with you. It does certainly have a lack of conviction when it comes to the character arcs. And I would be curious to find out what is in that cut footage.
Exactly. Like when you said this was, you know, that there's a director's cut, I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like there's like story elements missing.
That we're not seeing. Yeah. And,
It feels like, I don't know, was stuff cut to make a more studio friendly edit. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I thought of when you said that. So
yes,
that I would be interested in seeing that.
So a little background. I had us watch this movie when we did, sort of as an acknowledgement of Pride Month. And Mark Christopher, who wrote and directed this, did a bunch of short films, were well known within, what the critic B. Ruby Rich called a new queer cinema in the early 90s. So it came out of the same, group of directors like Greg Araki and Todd Haynes.
Did this movie come out before or after Boogie Nights? I feel like it was before.
So yeah, he sort of came out of that group of the directors, and you just asked about Boogie Nights. This movie came out around the same time that there was this sort of resurging interest in the disco days. I think it just started to become kind of cool to look back at that era again. Boogie Nights, I think 54 came out in what, 98, I said?
Yeah, 98.
And Boogie Nights came out in 97.
Oh, interesting. I feel like this movie feels like it came out before Boogie Nights. Like, again, I feel like Boogie Nights is sort of the better version of this movie.
Right, and it has a lot of similarities.
Now it feels like it, you know, the Boogie Nights did so well that it almost feels like they were trying to capitalize on that sort of edgy cinema. And that's the other thing about, and maybe it's just like the times are so different now. I didn't think this movie was that edgy or salacious.
No, maybe it was in the edited version. Whit Stillman's The Last Days of Disco also came out in 1998. But
you know what I mean? It was just like, sure, people were fucking and doing cocaine. Like, that just doesn't seem that bad to me.
So what I think that the story is, there's the movie story, the like kind of weak rise and fall story of Studio 54 and Steve Rubell.
Steve Rubell.
And we're sort of seeing it through this sort of blank canvas of a character played by Ryan Philippe, who's decidedly uninteresting. And would really need to be in the movie all that much, except for, I think if you're looking through the movie through the queer lens, this story does play into some of those themes, not necessarily obviously Steve Rubell's character is gay and, you know, kind of outwardly so. And a big part of what the disco movement as a whole and what Studio 54 represented was sort of a sea change in the visibility of gay people and what that meant in culture as a large when it became sort of cool. Like, this is sort of the period where actors and musicians were claiming to be bisexual when they weren't, just because it was kind of like at that time kind of cool. And I think that that's the story that the director was more interested in telling, was sort of the subtextual story of a person who goes and finds this adopted family.
Yeah.
Kind of leaves Jersey and then enters into this bright, colorful, expressive world that comes with its own, you know, set of dangers and whatever, but finds himself in that world, or, you know, discovers his own strength as a person in that world. I think that's the story that that the director is more interested in telling, but has to do it sort of through code in this kind of rather bland rise and fall story.
So, can I tell you the more interesting movie?
Boogie Nights?
Well, yeah. So, I think, and it's not Ryan Felipe's fault. I think he's a decent enough actor. I think he just had, you know, really nothing to do here.
Yeah, he's, I think this, he's as good as he could be with what he had.
I think this movie would have been more interesting if it followed the Breckenmeyer character.
Agreed.
And if they had sort of, like, given him that a similar arc to that. Like, you know, this married guy who's embezzling money, and you could even have, you know, the coming out story with that, you know, and I don't know. I think that would be more interesting to see. I don't know, to see someone struggle with it and not,
you mean
not
dealing with it. So you mean metaphorically,
not hit the sexuality aspect of it, but like, you know, maybe the societal pressure of that sexuality. I think that's the more interesting story than just sort of Ryan Felipe going to a club.
Yeah. And there is if we can only speculate on what was cut out of the movie, I think there stuff. I mean, this was released by Miramax, and without getting into everything, one of Harvey Weinstein's nicknames was Harvey Scissorhands, because he was known for chopping people's movies up pretty heavily.
Oh God, I thought that was going to go way different.
Especially foreign films, because Miramax bought a lot of foreign films and brought them to America, movies like Rumble in the Bronx and that kind of stuff. And he was really bad on those. But until Tarantino kind of started curating those things himself and made sure that they were kind of taken care of. But yes, even some of these movies, you know, first time feature directors and that kind of
stuff. Gotcha. Yeah. It feels very much like a 90s thing. Like, this feels like it's date. It's funny. It doesn't feel like a 70s movie. It feels like a 90s movie.
Feels like a lot because of the cast as well. But yeah, I think it definitely dates the worst out of the three movies I mentioned about disco that came out at that time. Boogie Nights, Last Days of Disco, and this. It's kind of lazy to say like, oh, well, Boogie Nights did it better, but it just kind of did. Now, I don't think it necessarily has the queer subtext in the same way.
No, yeah.
And I think that is interesting. Looking at the movie as this is a person who came out of new queer cinema, and it's sort of, you know, the late 90s is when a lot of directors like Todd Haynes and Greg Araki and all these people started making mainstream movies with that sensibility, and that is interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, for sure.
But you know, other than looking at it as sort of a historical piece, the movie itself, not that interesting at all. Other than that lead performance supporting performance, I suppose, by Mike Myers.
Did he win an Oscar for that?
I don't even know if he was nominated. I think the movie was too much of a blip on the radar to garner him that. There was some discussion about the performance. I think he was respected among his peers. Certainly came up on like Inside the Actor Studio, but no, I don't think it was his big Oscar moment.
Yeah, because I don't know. I thought his performance was enough to sort of keep me in it.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, you talk about the Breckenmeyer character being the entry into the film. I think also the Steve Rubell character could have. That's interesting enough. Just him, like, starting this club, deciding to embezzle. And, like, you know, his, you know, obviously there's a lot. It says a lot about this kind of short, nebbishy dude deciding who's cool enough to come into his club, that, you know, he's obviously sort of projecting his own insecurities. That's a story in and of itself, and the much more interesting one. Actually, if people really want to see, you know, the story of Studio 54 in a way that's really engaging, I say look back at like the 1998 documentary, the Behind the Music on the subject, which I think sells this in a much more engaging way in 1 hour, 45 minutes, than this movie does in 93.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah, I wanted to see more of Mike Myers. I was just like, I don't know.
And there was another guy who opened the club with him who was like almost a non-character in this one. Like, he's barely in it.
And they almost treat him like sort of like a devil character, which I think is a little weird.
Mephistopheles kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I
know what you mean. And especially since, like, I mean, let's just say what's happening here. Like, Michael Myers is like in pretty extreme Jew face in this movie. Like, heavily prostheticized. That can be kind of uncomfortable. Maybe it's not a choice we would make now. I'm not so sure.
I don't know.
But his performance is strong enough that I think he actually can wear that makeup and pull it off.
And I think he does look quite a bit like Steve Urkel. Yeah. Like, Steve Urkel was thinner and gaunter, but I don't know. I think he actually does a pretty compelling transformation. I see what you're saying, but I don't know. To me, it wasn't. It didn't seem cartoonish. It seemed like they were trying to portray a real guy. But
yeah,
I think the problem is, again, the movie refusing to take sort of a moral stance. Like, it flirts with Steve Urkel as this sort of devil figure, but it never fully commits to that idea.
But he's also sort of the adopted father in a lot of ways. And at the end of the movie, they almost deify him in a way. So, and I think that if you look at Steve Urkel as being, if you see this all as sort of a queer metaphor, and you see him as Ryan Phillippe's journey into that world, you can see Steve Urkel like first being kind of a scary prospect and then later sort of incorporating that into his personhood, right? And I think, again, the subtextual story is far more interesting than the literal story we're getting.
Exactly. And I think there's so many different ways they could have gone about that rather than doing this sort of, you know, paint by numbers biopic.
Agreed.
Kind of thing.
Agreed.
So, I don't know. Maybe one day that director's cut will see the light of day.
Oh, it has. It's on Netflix, and I think you get it on Blu-ray. And Outfest premiered it here in LA.
It's not on Netflix because we.
Or not Netflix. I'm sorry. Amazon Prime.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wish I would have known that. Oh, well.
Okay, so what did you want to sign for me next? The next time we do an episode, you might not be on the show for a little while, but...
Yeah, so I wanted to assign to you, I think it was about a year ago that we watched the National Lampoon documentary, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead. Yeah. And in the last year, Netflix made a comedy movie, like not a non-documentary, like a scripted story, called A Futile and Stupid Gesture.
Okay.
It's a telling of the story, but like with care in non-documentary form.
Okay. A biopic.
Yeah. So that's what I'm assigning you. A Futile and Stupid Gesture. I don't know. I think there's something very strange about the fact that there's like two National Lampoon movies that came out in the last year.
They might have been produced simultaneously or like through two different companies or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's something interesting there to talk about.
So. For sure. Especially since we already know that story. Now we'll see how they dramatize it.
Yeah. Starring Will Forte. So.
Cool. Well, that's the show. If anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about in this episode, you can contact us through our email at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at jabberpodcast or Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're also on Instagram at jabberpodcast as well. And you can stream us and listen to our archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com or any of your favorite podcatchers like iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can read my reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at salvorkreviews.blogspot.com. You can follow me on Twitter individually at BC Cassidy, B as in Victor. And you can also read some content that I've provided for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Where do they find your stuff?
Go to my website at www.keithfosterkid.com. Check me out on Instagram and Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. I have a couple shows coming up in a couple weeks. July 27th, me and my wife Ashley are doing an improv show at Twigs on Park at 8 p.m. There's a bunch of different improv shows going on that night. And then the next night, July 28th, is the last night to catch a book club, an improvised comic book. Mm-hmm. So come check that out.
Okay, cool. We have friends who do podcasts that you should be listening to. Keith, I think you have a couple. Why don't you go ahead and say those?
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast. That's all for now.
Okay. Be sure to listen to Rod and Denise over at the Listening Party, or Rod and Moksha over at the Listening Party. Also, check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought / Let's Start a Cult, and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. And I just wanted to kind of use this, the end of the show here, to talk about something that happened within our podcast community, our pod family, if you will. Patrick has his shows, Almost Educational, which he does with his friend Dennis, that I believe he's continuing to do. But his original show, Make Dad Read Comics, has come to an end rather suddenly through the passing of his father. And he just announced this on Twitter the other day. And he did a final episode by himself and talked about just, you know, the memories of the show, his dad, the people who listened and supported the show. And I just wanted to say sort of at the, you know, the end of the podcast here, that our hearts go out to him and his family. And Patrick's been a great friend, both personally and a friend of the podcast and a supporter of our show. And, you know, we've had him on several times, and I've been on Make Dad Read Comics. It's super sad, and it's a bummer to see that show end, because it was really, really, really good content.
I want to say, like, I've never met Patrick in person. I've only talked to him, through his podcast and through our podcast and, mm-hmm. and through Twitter. But it's very clear. It's very clear that he had a really good relationship with his dad, and he was really lucky. And his dad, he just seemed like the sweetest. He was so funny too.
Yeah.
So we're thinking about you, Patrick.
And I want to encourage anybody who's never listened to Make Dad Read Comics to check out the archives. It's a really good show, and there's a lot of great episodes. And, you know, I think he's going to keep it going, keep it on his hosting site for a while. So check mm-hmm. that out for sure. And also support Almost Educational, which I think is going to continue as well. So I just want to leave it at that. And that'll be the show. Bye.
Godzilla. If isn't Godzilla, listeners, a reaction by the Japanese to the atomic bomb? Am I insane? My father was laughing at me and shaking his head like I just said that France and France, all the grass is blue.
Yes,
that sounds as stupid as that to you, isn't it?
It's the first time I heard it.
Are you serious? The first time you ever heard that? Have you ever seen a Godzilla movie?
You can make things up about that. I wouldn't know. How would I know? That's why I think you make things.
You can research it. See, you won't research it. That's the thing.
Well, I researched this one. I never heard of this one.
You don't research
anything. Some of your stuff, I almost said crap. I've heard of. But this one, I never heard of.
This Godzilla you never heard of?
No.
This is blowing my mind right now.
And Akira. Yeah. Now it makes sense that Akira could be a Godzilla.
Okay, but don't you see, like, didn't I just make the connection that Akira
is... But if I never knew that there was a Godzilla who was, how would I know that Akira was?
Oh, my God.
You said that. That's how you get me sometimes.
How do I get you? What do you mean, how do I get you sometimes?
Well, because my ignorance of certain things, like Godzilla's origination.
Yeah.
You can link it to Akira. Yeah. I can't do that. I don't know anything about a Godzilla, he's a big sea monster.